You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Hello, and welcome to this podcast, Integrating Comprehensive Molecular Profiling to Improve Outcomes in HER2-Altered Non-Small Cell Lung Cancer, Challenges and Solutions. Given the exciting data on new HER2-targeted therapies, understanding the barriers and challenges of incorporating molecular testing for all patients with advanced non-small cell lung cancer is critical to improving overall patient outcomes. I'm Dr. Eric Singhi. I'm a thoracic medical oncologist, and I'm very pleased to be joined by my colleague, Dr. Bruna Pellini, Chief of Thoracic Medical Oncology at Baptist Health Herbert Wertheim Cancer Institute in beautiful Miami, Florida. Dr. Pellini, thanks for joining.
Thank you for having me, Dr. Singhi.
Absolutely. Thanks for coming back for episode two. Today, we're going to be discussing the barriers and offer possible solutions to improving the incorporation of very important comprehensive molecular testing for all of our patients with advanced non-small cell lung cancer. So let's get into it. The first thing I want to talk to you about, Dr. Pellini, is the importance of timely biomarker identification. And that should include HER2 as a now actionable target. And I want to emphasize it again, the word timely. It's no longer enough to simply test, because we have data that now shows us that when testing happens matters just as much as whether it happens or not, right? Can you talk us through this importance of timing?
Yes, absolutely. So over the past decades, we have learned in thoracic oncology that giving the best drug first will lead to prolonged disease control that is much longer than giving the same drug in the second line setting or third line setting. Right now, we have a drug approved in the first line setting for HER2 mutant non-small cell lung cancer, that is zongertinib. So this targeted therapy can be given the first line setting, and it actually leads to prolonged disease control. We have overall response rates of 76%. We have median progression-free survival over a year for around 14 months. But if we don't give this drug in the first line setting, the numbers won't look as good in terms of disease control, duration of disease control. So that's why the timely testing is so important, because if we don't test for HER2 mutations when patients present with stage four disease, we may be losing the opportunity to give them now a targeted therapy. Because for these patients, if we don't look for this specific alteration, we're going to be giving them chemotherapy, or maybe even chemoimmunotherapy, which, again, in my opinion, is not the best treatment choice. And more importantly, we could potentially be giving a therapy that it's not going to work, that is, it's single agent immunotherapy in general for the most common HER2 alteration. It doesn't really work. And these tumors may express high PD-L1, but it doesn't mean the immunotherapy will work in the setting. So again, if you don't test, you are going to have just one piece of the puzzle, but not the entire puzzle.
Yeah. And it's important that we have all those pieces, right? Because we are obsessed with the details as thoracic medical oncologists. We want to make sure our patients are on the right track, not the wrong track, and then their outcomes suffer, right? So I think super important to make sure we get these tests as quickly as we can. And you mentioned and highlighted that data, right? We have real-world data now that shows us that if we have all the biomarker tests in hand before we start a treatment, those are the patients that have the longest overall survival compared to upfront non-NGS testing, delayed NGS testing, you name it, or no NGS testing at all, right? So I think it's so important. Let me ask you, though, in the real-world setting, if we don't have the test results before a patient needs to get started on treatment because of disease burden, you feel like truly it's the cancer that's causing a lot of their symptoms, what should we do?
Yes, excellent question. We should give these patients chemotherapy, good old chemotherapy. One cycle can control the disease symptoms and can buy you time. I think the biggest mistake that we can make as oncologists is rush. And rushing means giving a generic treatment without having the full information. Chemotherapy doesn't stay in a person's body for too long. And we can easily transition from one cycle of platinum doublet to targeted therapy if we find this alteration. But now, if you decide to give immunotherapy, guess what? The half-life of immunotherapy is 22 days, 20 plus days. So now you have a drug that remains in the patient's system for almost 4 months. And you don't really understand the interactions with certain agents that are targeted therapies. I mean, we know from EGFR mutant lung cancer that the rates of pneumonitis increase substantially if a patient had received immunotherapy and was put on a third generation TKI, EGFR TKI, or any EGFR TKI for that matter. So in this setting, we have some data because some patients in these trials have been treated with chemo and immunotherapy. That doesn't appear to have a huge signal in terms of increasing toxicities, but we still don't know. The data is still limited, right? And so I think more importantly, not even talking about the risk of toxicity, you're giving something that the patient doesn't need and it's not going to help. So it's financial toxicity there.
Yeah. And, you know, even NCCN guidelines explicitly addresses this. If there is this urgent situation, you have a patient who needs to start some type of urgent systemic therapy, but biomarker testing is pending. NCCN even recommends go ahead and hold the immunotherapy for one cycle, right? Unless you're sure that there are no driver mutations present, because exactly what you said, certain driver mutation subgroups may not even be effective. And second, and more importantly, potentially even harmful, right? If you get them or try to get them onto the right therapy. So I think both of those points, which you highlighted, are spot on and guideline recommended. Let's talk about HER2 mutations now a little bit more specifically with regards to all the different types of molecular testing techniques that are out there. And maybe you can walk us through them. So talk us through maybe the pros and cons of using broad next generation sequencing NGS, looking specifically for HER2 mutations.
Well, the advantage of using broad next-generation sequencing is obvious. You are testing for every single genetic alteration that is commonly found in non-small cell lung cancer, and that can open the door for a therapeutic opportunity. The downside is the time that the test results will be available for us to review and make our clinical decisions. I have a very different perspective now, Dr. Singhi. I used to work in a standalone academic cancer center before I transitioned to my new position. And in my new role, we have 12 hospitals in our system. So we are seeing a lot of patients coming from all these different hospitals that we have to our cancer institute. And sometimes there's a huge delay between being seen by their pulmonologist in one of the hospitals and having an appointment in our cancer institute that is the main cancer institute and the only cancer institute in our health system. So the patient has been waiting weeks before they see us. And then we say, well, now I need you to wait 3 more weeks for me to have the broad NGS results, right? Here, this is not happening as much because we created a process, and I'm very proud of our healthcare system, that our pathologists can order the reflex testing under our names, you know, because we understand that time is of the essence. But then I'm very empathetic with our colleagues practicing in smaller rural areas, smaller cancer centers, that nothing is connected. They have to, the biopsies done in one hospital, they see the patients in their cancer center, and then they have to send out the testing. So here, at least, everything tends to be done within my healthcare system, which has its challenges. But imagine our colleagues that don't have this connection. And you, in an academic setting, everything is done in-house. So it's the fastest process or the smoothest process. So I think we need to understand the challenges that our colleagues face. But that doesn't mean they should rush. It just means that we need to set expectations with our patients and discuss the timeline once we meet them and why it's important. And I'm going to tell you, Dr. Singhi, I have not had one patient not understand when I spend just a few minutes expressing and explaining the importance of waiting.
Yeah, I love that. And I love that you take the time, right? You know that education is a really big passion for me as well. And so I am very heavily invested. And that's why I think podcasts like this for our colleagues, podcasts as well to extend education to patients, patient advocates, their families is so important to understand that it is well worth the wait to get this biomarker testing, particularly next generation sequencing, particularly multi-gene panel testing. So I echo your sentiment and I applaud you for your efforts to make sure we're really bridging the gap amongst all the different oncology stakeholders. I want to ask you one more question before we transition to diving more into those barriers and potentially solutions. Is there any role still, Dr. Pelini, for single gene testing?
Honestly, I know our audience is going to be US-based. I don't think there is. I think this shouldn't be done anymore. I think our healthcare system has allowed us and empowered us to do broad NGS. So I don't see why any of us should do single gene testing. There's too many genes to test. And the analogy that I like to make is, you wanna eat the full slice of pizza. If you know you're gonna eat it all, why are you grabbing tiny bites each time? Just go for the full slice, you know? So you need that information. So don't go one by one. But again, I think it requires so many stakeholders for the practices to change. We talk a lot about us as oncologists, but we're really talking about how policies in healthcare systems have to shift to allow us as medical oncologists to have the test results when patients see us. So I think reflex testing and the fact that there's questions whether pathologists could be ordering tests, to me, is baffling, mind-boggling, you know? I think this goes to a level of policy that there needs to be discussions so pathologists, molecular pathologists, to order this test on our behalf.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack there, right? The policies, the institution level, sort of mannerisms, intrinsic at each institution specifically. I love analogies, you know this. And so I love your analogy about the pizza and eating the pie. My analogy for single gene testing, what I tell people is when you do single gene testing, it's almost like you're reading just one chapter out of the book and you think you know the whole story, right? But you don't. You have to look to be able to figure out if there is more to the story than just that one chapter. And so when I explain it to people like that, like, okay, I think I get it, right? And the other thing too is I point to data. Data shows us that patients who got single gene testing, they're less likely to have all 9 guideline, or at least 10 now, guideline biomarkers tested, right? And so if you only look at one, you get this fragmented sort of piece of the puzzle, right? The piece of the pie, if you will, the piece of the story, we'll name whatever analogy we want to use. And so I agree. I think, you know, really pushing for comprehensive testing, multi-gene panel testing is very important today.
Yes, I agree. I like your analogy better, but it seems like I'm more of a foodie than you are. So
No, I will join you for pizza very soon, I'm sure. Let's move to a topic that you're very passionate and well-informed about, and that's finding biomarker results, not only through tissue testing, but liquid biopsies. Talk us through the pros and cons of each approach. Are they competing?
Excellent question. The answer is no, they're not competing. Okay, so they're complementary. And honestly, the societies in general, ASCO, International Society of Liquid Biopsy, we all vouch for parallel testing, not sequential testing. So here's the reason why. The liquid biopsy testing is great, but it's not perfect. So if you find the genomic alteration that is driving this cancer, amazing, go and treat, believe the results. The specificity is extremely high. You shouldn't doubt the genomic findings from that. Now, if you don't find, that's where you have to pause and understand that the tissue is complementary. The tissue is not only complementary, it's needed. Why is that? Let's talk, and now I'm going to nerd out because you know this is my area of research. Circulating tumor DNA stays in the bloodstream anywhere between 15 minutes to 2 hours. So depending when you collect the blood, you may have it or you may not. And also, you have to understand that the assay doesn't know what is ctDNA and what is cell-free DNA that is coming from normal cells or white blood cells. So we have a lot of normal cell-free DNA in the background, and you're just trying to find the small amount that is actually coming from the tumor. So again, if you don't have enough, you may miss it. So that's my point. So again, if you have a liquid biopsy that shows a HER2 mutation, believe it, treat it. If you don't, you still need your tissue, especially if you have only variants of unknown significance, or if you only have TP53 mutations. We all know patients have a lot of clonal hematopoiesis, and TP53 is the most common mutation in white blood cells. So you may be seeing a clonal hematopoiesis in the liquid biopsy and not seeing the TP53 mutation that is necessarily coming from the tumor. So again, tissue testing is needed.
Yeah. Thanks for pointing out that false negative concern and the reasoning behind, the science behind why that may happen. And so I think we can safely say then that tissue and liquid biopsies are not competitors. They may be teammates, right? And so they're good to work together and in parallel. I really like that approach. And that's also the approach that I use. I want to talk to you next about barriers, right? Because we constantly talk about, in the ideal world, biomarker testing for all, regardless of where you're coming from, what you look like, what zip code you live in. But unfortunately, that is not the reality today, right? We have a lot of different barriers, structural barriers, tissue barriers, care coordination barriers. Dr. Pelini, if you could pick the biggest one today, what would you say it is and how do we approach it?
I think care coordination is a huge barrier. And I alluded to that previously because unless you are working in a center where everything has been done in that center or in that healthcare system, you're going to have challenges between coordination and the delays won't be in the execution of the testing. It will be into getting the tissue to the right people that can order the test and then sending to the company that will execute the test. So I think care coordination, it's going to be, in my opinion, number one challenge. And tissue stewardship is aligned within, is embedded in, within this context of care coordination. I think where the tissue is and the people involved in the communication are responsible for so many other processes within their institutions that sometimes the prioritization is not sending the tissue to another institution, but that represents a patient, you know? And I think that's where the detachment is. Like, I don't think the people that are assisting us necessarily understand what the job that they're executing means to our patients and their families.
Yeah, I completely agree. You know, and I'll echo your sentiment about care coordination. It's a real issue. If you think about the diagnostic journey, it involves multiple handoffs at multiple time points, right? So typically it's the proceduralist, then that goes to the pathologist, then it goes to the molecular lab, then it goes finally to us medical oncologists in clinic. And delays can happen at each transition point. And so I 100% agree. Our group actually led a pilot study recently trying to integrate nurse navigators, which are often the first point of contact, to go through the patient chart, identify if molecular testing has been done. If so, was it comprehensive? If so, what are the results? And how do we improve the initiation or start of treatment for patients so they can get to those outcomes more quickly, more seamlessly, more efficiently? And so definitely applaud and coordinate all those efforts kind of being done together collectively to get those results faster for patients and their families. I want to talk to you a little bit more about molecular profiling specifically for HER2 and whether that means overexpression, whether it means a mutation. You know, it opens the door for different therapies. And Dr. Pelini, you mentioned having efficacious CNS penetrant drugs. Talk us through sort of this landscape before we do a deep dive. Just set the 360 aerial view of what's happened in this landscape, particularly for not only extracranial outcomes, but intracranial outcomes as well.
Excellent point. So right now, talking about HER2 mutations, we have three drugs that are available in second line and beyond, and one that is available in first line. So zongertinib is a targeted therapy, is available in the first line setting, and that has some CNS activity. But there's still ongoing studies whether the dose that the drug is approved now is the best dosing to get to the CNS activity that we want. So there's a question mark there. Yes, there is some CNS activity, but maybe the current approved dose is not optimal for the disease control in the brain that we want. So that's number one. Then when we talk about savabertinib, similarly, there is some CNS activity as well. Some data is emerging. And T-DXd, we do have data in CNS activity as well. It's an antibody drug conjugate, so different than zongertinib and savabertinib. But again, I think for all of these drugs, there's a lot of room for us to better understand the true CNS efficacy and to treat more patients and get some real world evidence. That would be my take-home points on CNS activity.
That's perfect. And it's going to set the stage for episode 3 and our discussion that we have next. You know, I'll echo this sentiment of excitement and enthusiasm. You can hear it in my voice because for the first time in thoracic oncology, we can finally tell patients with HER2 mutant lung cancer that have brain metastases that, hey, we actually have an oral pill that shows that it has the potential to shrink your brain tumors. And we've had an IV drug, this antibody drug conjugate, that can not only do that, but also has shown us being able to achieve complete intracranial responses. And so I think hopefully we continue to expand on those outcomes. You're absolutely right. Trying to figure out the dose, trying to really get over that blood-brain barrier to make sure we see those improved outcomes for patients. So thank you so much. I'm really looking forward to picking your brain in our next episode, no pun intended. But Dr. Pelini, I think that's all we have time for. I want to thank you again so much for sharing your practical insights, talking through the importance of integrating molecular profiling for all of our patients with advanced non-small cell lung cancer to guide targeted therapy to improve outcomes. We hope you enjoyed this second episode out of our 3-episode series. This podcast was brought to you by MedLearning Group. MedLearning Group is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. This CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACCME Essentials. This is a non-promotional educational disease state awareness initiative supported by an independent educational grant from Boehringer Ingelheim Pharmaceuticals, Inc. So thank you for joining.